Welcome to the Engines of Texana, Episode 8, Making Texas Cool. I'm Brandon C. A party was underway at the historic St. Charles Hotel in New Orleans on a humid July evening in 1869. The partygoers were going to dine that evening on Texas beef, which wasn't necessarily a novelty in and of itself. New Orleans had been a regular destination for Tejano trail drives going back 150 years. Most famously, in 1779, some 2,000 head of Texas cattle had been sent to the Spanish governor of Louisiana to help support the rebellion of 13 English colonies along the Atlantic seaboard. And yet the Texas beef that was going to be served that evening in July of 1869 hadn't been driven to New Orleans. It had been shipped there in a cold storage vessel, frozen. The entire affair had been constructed as a contest to see who could get frozen Texas beef to New Orleans first. And two vessels had arrived from Texas within days of each other, but each used a different refrigeration technology. The first relied on dry ice, carbon dioxide frozen via a process developed by a pioneering balloonist named Thaddeus Lowe from Dallas. And although his vessel arrived first in New Orleans, it was so heavily laden that it sat too low in the water to enter New Orleans harbor. And so Dr. Howard Payton of San Antonio slipped in behind him with a more modest steamship outfitted with a smaller cold storage locker, and he took the prize. But that the winner of a refrigeration contest had come out of San Antonio in 1869 wasn't really a surprise, because in the years following the Civil War, San Antonio had become a hotbed of ice-making innovation. Prior to the Civil War, Texans had relied on New England merchants to ship them blocks of ice from way up north, packing it tight with sawdust or straw for insulation. And yet the northern blockade of southern ports during the Civil War had cut off Texans from their ice supply. Entrepreneurs jumped into the void. The most promising technology of the day came from a Frenchman named Ferdinand Carré, or I guess Carré to say it the French way. The key to making a space cooler actually isn't to make it cooler, Carré and other innovators realized. It's to make the space not hot. That is, to remove the heat from the space. Carré's process heated up an ammonia water mixture to increase its pressure, and then pushed that high-pressure ammonia water through a small hole into a lower-pressure chamber. The expansion of the high-pressure mixture into the low-pressure chamber created a cooling effect. Think of a spray paint can after you've been spraying it for a while, or a valve stem on a tire if you let the air out quickly. If you then circulate the now cooler, lower-pressure mixture through a conduit into a warmer space, the mixture will eventually absorb some of the heat from the warmer space and carry it on out of the room. You can then heat up and pressure up the mixture again, run it back through the small restriction into the lower pressure chamber again to cool it off, and then just keep cycling the fluid indefinitely until you've absorbed all the heat out of the room via the cooling fluid. Someone in San Antonio caught wind of this process, possibly because San Antonio had strong cultural ties to France, owing to a string of French bishops and religious orders in the heavily Catholic city, as well as a small but very prominent French immigrant community there. Also, in 1862, the French Emperor Napoleon III imposed an Austrian Archduke on the throne of Mexico, which essentially made San Antonio's closest trading partner a French outpost. For the next 5 years, French-controlled Mexico bought uncounted tons of the blockaded South's cotton that was left stranded by the same blockade that had cut off ice shipments to Texas, and San Antonio merchants brought back French trade goods on their return trips to Texas. The road from San Antonio to Matamoros became known as the Wisps of Cotton Road because of all the stray cotton fibers lining the trail, and many San Antonio trading houses built their fortunes on this trade. In 1863, someone set up a Carré Aqua Ammonia Absorption Refrigeration Machine, as it was called, in Matamoros. And then somehow, in 1865, a Confederate Signal Corps major named Daniel Livingston Holden got a hold of one of these Carré refrigeration machines and moved it to San Antonio. The Carré machine, however, like many other early attempts at mechanical refrigeration, worked far better in theory than it did in practice. And so Holden set himself to the task of making a Carré machine actually work. First, instead of directly heating the ammonia water mixture with a wood fire, Holden ran steam coils through the mixture so that he could heat it in a more controlled manner. Second, the hard water that he was using initially from San Pedro Springs kept fouling his equipment with calcium buildup, and he realized that he could achieve much more consistent results by using distilled water, which had the added benefit of producing super clear ice, clearer even than natural ice, which made for great marketing. And third, he swapped out the ammonia water mixture in favor of petroleum ether, which was, again, safer, cheaper, and more consistent. Holden's work was sufficient to earn him a handful of patents and resulted in the, quote, most complete ice machine ever erected, end quote, as the press at the time called it. Holden's machine spit out one 20-pound block of ice every 4 minutes, which Holden then sold for 10 cents per pound. A cluster of ice-making innovation took off in Texas. In 1867, U.S. Census reports counted 5 ice-making plants in the entire United States, 3 of which were in San Antonio. Another French immigrant in San Antonio, named Andrew Muell, set up his own ether ice machine that year. And Charles Zilker, of Zilker Park fame in Austin, got his start too in San Antonio around the same time with an ammonia absorption unit before moving his headquarters to Austin. Charles Ball in Sherman, Texas, and David Boyle in Jefferson, Texas, were also soon experimenting with their own designs. And Thaddeus Lowe of Dallas, the one who had lost the frozen beef race to New Orleans, continued working on dry ice. In fact, his carbon dioxide refrigeration compressors, which could get much colder than ammonia or petroleum ether absorption units, would become the standard for marine transport and refrigeration for the next 70 years, until the invention of Freon. But one of the things that I find most interesting is that at a cost of between $30,000 to $70,000 per unit, at a time when the entire capital investment in the state of Texas was only like $3 million or so, each one of these ice plants represented something like 2% of the state's plant capacity. It's the 19th century equivalent of building a new car manufacturing plant or a refinery or a semiconductor production line. And having so many different innovators working in the same space at the same time had the predictable result of driving prices down from 10 cents a pound to 1 cent per pound of ice in just the first decade. This rapid decline in price allowed Texas entrepreneurs to look for more novel applications for ice. And their attention landed on the same place that Gail Borden's had and where countless generations of trail-driving Tejanos had as well, on figuring out how to get 2 cent per pound Texas beef to a 6 cent per pound East Coast market and capture that margin. Gail Borden's meat biscuit had not been the answer, but maybe 1 cent per pound ice could be. Because there was another savings implicit in shipping frozen beef versus live cattle. For frozen, you only had to ship the trimmed carcass, half or so of the weight of the animal. And you don't have to feed a carcass. Cattle feed was additional cost and burden of shipping live cattle. Once again, Daniel Livingston Holden, the adapter of the first Carré machine, led the way. In 1871, he opened the first mechanically refrigerated abattoir in America in Fulton, Texas, which was soon packing 100 carcasses a day for shipment to Liverpool, England. A former Holden associate named Thomas Rankin developed the first refrigerated rail cars in North Texas the same year, and in 1873 made the first successful shipment of chilled beef from Texas all the way to New York. His beef carcasses arrived 4 days and 22 hours after they had been shipped, still perfectly frozen and ready for sale. Chicago meatpacker Gustavus Swift liked the idea so much that in 1875, he began to build a fleet of refrigerated rail cars. His largest competitor, Armour and Company, followed suit, and by the turn of the century, Swift and Armour had made Fort Worth the major frozen meatpacking center in the state. In fact, meatpacking briefly constituted the largest quote-unquote manufacturing industry in Texas from 1909 to 1919, when oil refining took over. But if cattle gave the impetus to Texans' efforts to drive down the price of mechanical refrigeration and ice making, it would be that truly dominant Texas industry, cotton, that would bring cooling to the people. As late as 1929, only 2% of the textile mills in the United States were located in Texas, despite the fact that the state grew something like 40% of American cotton at the time. So why did faraway places like Massachusetts and New England dominate the final, most valuable stages of cotton production when it seems like it would have been much cheaper to finish the raw product right where it was produced? Well, the problem was climate. Textile mills needed to keep the air inside their facilities exceedingly moist in order to keep the cotton fibers elastic but tough enough to be able to card spin and weave them. This was something called yarn conditioning. Textile mills achieved this by pumping steam onto the factory floor, something which was tolerable in a mild northern summer, but insufferable in the hot and humid south. Around 1895, a textile engineer from North Carolina named Stuart Kramer decided to set himself to the task of conditioning the air in a textile mill, not the yarn. So-called air conditioning, as he came to call it, meant not only controlling the room's temperature, however, it meant controlling its humidity, quality, and distribution, the four characteristics that would come to define our modern understanding of air conditioning. As the science of air conditioning advanced, and like ice making, the cost came down, new applications began to benefit from its use. Entrepreneurs like Willis Carrier in New York pushed the technology into printing, flour, cigarettes, gunpowder, chocolate, all things that benefited from a climate-controlled setting. The New York Stock Exchange became the world's first fully air-conditioned office space. But air conditioning, of course, was only really necessary for like 2 months out of the year in a place like New York, which made it harder to recover the capital investment. In a place like Texas, however, you had most of the calendar year to help you amortize the expense. And in places like the Golden Triangle in East Texas in the 1920s, you had oil wealth willing to pay for a bit of comfort. The First Presbyterian Church of Orange, situated right in the shadow of Spindletop's Bounty, FYI, claims to be the first air-conditioned building in Texas. The original system installed in 1912 sounds suspiciously like a fan with an ice maker to me, but nevertheless, by 1929, it was clear that they had a complete carrier-designed air-conditioning system installed. The Rice Hotel in Houston, which sits, incidentally, on the spot of the old Republic of Texas Capitol building when the Capitol was in Houston, the Rice Hotel air-conditioned its cafeteria in 1922. That was the same year that the 21-story Milam building in San Antonio, named after Ben Milam from The Siege of Bear in Season 1, if you want to go brush up, opened up to much fanfare as the world's first fully air-conditioned building. In 1936, the St. Anthony Hotel, right down the street from the Milam, became the world's first fully air-conditioned hotel, the same year that Josky's department store around the corner became the first fully air-conditioned department store in Texas. And yet most Texans' first experience with air conditioning wasn't in an office building or a luxury hotel or a fancy department store. It was in a movie theater. The American movie industry was exploding in the early 1920s and 30s. Something like half of Americans went to the cinema weekly. And yet Southern movie theaters effectively had to close their doors in the summers. It was too hot, too unbearable to sit in a crowded 100-degree enclosed room, no matter how good the movie. Which, from a financial standpoint, meant that any dollar that Texas movie theaters could make in the summer was a dollar that they weren't going to make otherwise. It was basically found money. Texas theaters jumped at the opportunity. The Old Mill Theater in Dallas in 1917 seems to have been the first mover in the state, and they marketed the hell out of it, promising patrons that they would be, quote, 100% cooler and more comfortable than they could possibly be at home, end quote. The Palace Theater, also in Dallas, and the Texan in Houston followed in 1924. By the 1930s and 40s, movie theaters across the state were competing on how cold they could get, decorating their exteriors with icicles, frost, and snow, and giving themselves brand names like Arctic Breezes and Siberian Zephyrs, making promises of 20 degrees cooler inside and never over 70 degrees. I feel like, but don't quite know how to prove, that the fact that air conditioning came to Texas with the movies had another profound impact on the Texas psyche, on the American psyche, maybe. Americans have always been good at reimagining what it is that makes them Americans, and coming of age during the dual national crises of the Great Depression and World War II, movies led the way in defining a new 20th century American identity. And by far, the most American of American film genres of this period was the Western, which was inseparable then as now from Americans' views of Texas and Texans' views of themselves. Western movies made Texas cool, if you'll forgive the pun, in a way that it had never been before, too. John Wayne's Alamo in 1960 represented the height of this. For a nation living through an ideological Cold War, unprecedented technological advancement, and rapidly changing demographics, Texas Westerns, quote, gave substance to the ideal of personal self-determination and responsible freedom that the realities of modern life and institutions seem to deny, end quote. And yet, the cinematization of Texas mythology for American audiences required homogenizing Texas a bit, and frankly, cherry-picking those aspects of Texanity that were most palatable to audiences in other parts of America. Which at the time meant firmly anchoring Texas mythology in the Anglo-American part of its identity. In this sense, it made Anglo-Texans more American. But it also pushed non-Anglo-Texans into the shadows, or into the role, in some cases, of antagonists. As movies came to replace older forms of entertainment based on ethnic and religious affiliation, they came to redraw the lines of culture in ways that would ripple through the social movements of the 1960s and into the present. With the worst drought in Texas history raging through the 1950s, air conditioning slowly transitioned from a nice-to-have to a have-to-have. In 1952, only 196 offices in all of Houston had air conditioning installed. 5 years later, it was basically a requirement to get people to come to work. One scholar has found that once 20% of office buildings in any one city have air conditioning, all the other buildings are basically required to install it to remain competitive. In a survey in 1957, 88% of companies said that air conditioning was the most important item for, quote, office efficiency. In a survey taken in 1957, 88% of companies said that air conditioning was the most important item for, quote unquote, office efficiency. And they were probably right. Recent studies have shown a 2% decrease in productivity for every degree above 77 degrees in a work setting. Home air conditioning units hit the markets in the 1940s. And by the 1950s, they were down to $500 a piece. Not cheap, but within reach. Led by innovators once again like San Antonio's Friedrich Air Conditioning and their window units, some of which still run to this day. By 1966, Texas became the first state to have half of its homes and apartments air-conditioned. And soon, central AC units were being installed in new homes throughout the state, but almost for purely economic reasons. Central air conditioning actually lowered the cost of new home construction. It eliminated the need for, quote, high-pitched roofs vented from top to bottom, open porches, broad eaves that blocked the slanting sun, massive doors and windows that sometimes stretched from door to ceiling, transoms placed above bedroom doors, dormers, groves of shade trees blanketing the southern exposure, and houses situated to capture prevailing winds, end quote. Instead, central AC allowed for a much more compact footprint, in homes as well as office buildings, so that in most cases, the AC system actually paid for itself in material savings. This, of course, changed and once again homogenized Americans' images of themselves and what home looked like. Aesthetics and economics aside, however, at a qualitative level, air conditioning also just improved life. Government studies found that residents of air-conditioned houses got, quote, more than an hour's extra sleep at night during the summer for each member of the family, daytime naps for children that stretched out three times longer, hot meals 40% more nutritious, enthusiastically eaten despite soaring outdoor temperatures, a $5.80 average weekly savings on outside entertainment, laundry time cut in half, and house cleaning time cut by one-third, end quote. Not to mention the other public health benefits of, quote, reduced fetal and infant mortality, prolonged lives for thousands of patients suffering from heart disease and respiratory disorders, increased reliability and sophistication of microsurgery, and the acceleration of the institutionalization of public health, which aided in the production of modern drugs such as penicillin, end quote. In 1965, the Astrodome opened its doors, calling itself the eighth wonder of the world in no small part because it was the world's largest air-conditioned space. In 1961, the Alamo had been air-conditioned. Air conditioning had conquered Texas's past, present, and future. By 1980, 83.2% of Texas households had air conditioning, and more than 90% of office buildings, banks, hotels, and hospitals did. By 1980, in fact, fully one-third of the tractors in the state were air-conditioned. Air conditioning, in the words of one scholar, led to a, quote, dramatic decline in regional distinctiveness, end quote, as well as, quote, the largest migration of human beings in the history of the United States, end quote. And for a country whose history has been built on people moving around, that's no small claim. But air conditioning made Texas comfortable, both psychologically and physically, for people from other parts of the United States. The first half of the 20th century, in fact, had seen a massive out-migration of 10 million people from the un-air-conditioned South. but the second half of that century saw an even larger immigration into the now air-conditioned Sun Belt. And their most common destination was Texas. Texas went from the sixth largest state in the Union in 1950 to the second largest by 2000, with a population today four times larger than it was in 1950. This wave of immigration hasn't really ever stopped, even through to the present, even during Texas's quite brutal economic depression in the 1980s. And it's just flat out impossible for me to imagine 30 million people living here in Texas today without air conditioning. I would argue that air conditioning has been the greatest engine of moving people around in this country in the last 100 years. And yet its role is largely unsung because its impact is so subtle. The next engine of Texanity, however, is much more widely appreciated. Actually, it's working for both of us right now, scribing everything I'm saying into little ones and zeros and spitting it back out to you in the form of a human voice. I'm talking about the integrated circuit. On the next episode of The Engines of Texanity. Thank you for listening. A special thanks on this episode to Friedrich Air Conditioning's product manager and resident historian, Chris McGee, a 19-year veteran of the company. And thanks to Friedrich Corporate for letting me use one of their old ads as the cover art for this episode. This season is brought to you by the 11th Street River House in Bandera, Texas. Sort of. My wife and I have dreamed for years about owning a place in Bandera, and we finally bought a house there last year. 4 blocks from the bars, 3 blocks from the Frontier Times Museum, with 120 feet of Medina River frontage and a collection of historic Texas maps on the wall, curated by yours truly, it's a great place to spend a weekend and to sort of indirectly support this podcast. Look it up under 11th Street River House on Airbnb or on VRBO. Editing for this episode was performed by Susana Canseco, sound engineering by Stephen Bennett. Stephen Bennett also composed and performed the theme music. You can find more about Stephen at info@nosomedia.com. David Moore designed the cover art for this season. You can find him at illustrationonline.com. For more information on our sources and other projects, please check out www.brandonseal.com.